out of the darkness of our past, out of the visions of our childhood, comes the one fear we thought we left behind, the one nightmare we hoped had gone away. But the evil we once invited in has found its way back home.
Hey, motherfuckers, you listen to Three Ring Radio, so fuck you.
Fuck you, man.
Fuck you!
Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. You're cool. And fuck you, I'm out.
Okay, fuck you. How's that?
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you! God!
Hey, fuck you, man!
Fuck you!
Fuck you! Fuck you!
Well, fuck you.
Fuck off, you donkey-raping shit-eater.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy. So, what I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie. The last time you're gonna see a bad guy like this again, let me tell you.
Visit the website at Mike Hunt's On Fire.
What?
Oh, God.
Dot com.
No.
Is that for real?
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Mike Hunt's On Fire.
That's the website.
Dot com.
Jackie's very upset that he didn't think of that first.
Jackie thought he owned that.
Y'all are killing me.
Ah, that's funny.
Within minutes, the boy vanished off the face of the earth. And one of the more significant factors at a later phase of this investigation was the fact that as the boy turned to leave the drugstore, he made the statement, "I'll be right back."
But his last words did lead police to a suspect, contractor John Wayne Gacy.
From there, experts say Kozinczak showed good instincts, although he'd been chief of detectives for only 6 months.
Knowingly or not, they had approached that case exactly the way it should have been dealt with, and they were very successful in breaking Gacy down.
Indeed, if the Des Plaines police had not pursued Gacy so quickly and so thoroughly, he may have had time to carry out a plan that would have concealed the murders forever.
He had said that he was going to make an addition, but he was going to go upwards. And then he was going to cement the crawl space. And then when this came out, we thought, well, nothing would have been found if he had done that.
And months earlier, a recurring water problem in the crawl space threatened to wash away Gacy's cover.
It was a nice warm day that day, and John Gacy's out there, and he's put a hole in the... and he run the holes out in the street, and he started draining out the water, pumping the water out. While he's pumping the water out, and that terrible smell coming out, Steve. I said, hey, John, I said, what, he got a bunch of dead bodies over there? He says, what do you mean? I said, what do I mean? It smells like a bunch of dead bodies. He said, oh, no, those are all dead field mice, you know.
Hello, Mr. Egan. Bob
Hello.
Egan.
Hello, Shane.
You're one of the people who killed John Wayne Gacy.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Yeah, I asked the jury to kill him, and they did.
Right. So you, well, that's an accomplishment you're proud of.
Oh yeah.
So I guess you, you know, I'm gonna start at the end here then of my questioning. Oh, maybe not. You know, how do you feel about the whole Well, this is so odd for me to hold a microphone in front of all these people. How does it feel for you to, with the whole Gacy court system thing, for me it seemed like a perversion of justice, no pun intended there with perversion, when Gacy got, how many years of appeals did he get? 16 years of appeals?
14. He was convicted in March of 1980, and he was executed in May of 1994. You have to understand there that everyone in his situation is entitled to what is basically three trips to the United States Supreme Court. The first one on the merits of the case, the second one to determine whether or not he had any constitutional violations, and the third one on as he goes through the federal system on habeas corpus. So that takes a long time.
Don't you think that's sort of obscene, though?
Well, I think everybody would like to see the death penalty effectuated sooner, especially where it's so clearly deserved as it was with John Gacy. The at the time of the execution, I was in touch with a lot of the victims, and you know, they talk about it, giving closure to the victims, closure to the victims' families and that sort of thing. The fact of the matter is that it opened a lot of wounds 14 years later, and I think everybody would have liked to see it happen sooner.
What do you think about kooky people that are against the death penalty? I mean, you said everyone wants to see the death penalty.
Well, everyone who I think is in favor of the death penalty, I don't think that people who are against it are necessarily kooky. They have their own beliefs, and the nice thing about America is that you're entitled to do that. But, you know, I wouldn't want them on my jury.
Should we be afraid of all clowns, Bob? Mr. Egan,
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think so. You know, it's funny, during the trial, we brought in literally a clown expert who told us about how clown makeup...
And this is the Gacy trial.
This is the Gacy trial. You know, you recall Pogo the Clown had his own self-applied makeup and that sort of thing. And you'll recall that his mouth was, and his eyes were triangular, and his mouth was turned up at points at the end.
Right.
And our expert said a clown never has sharp edges on his face. It connotes unfriendliness and
evil. Yeah,
if you will.
Something like that.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
That's interesting. Is Gacy, the Gacy case, the most famous case you've tried? And you did try this, right? You
were I did. I was one of the prosecutors that tried the case from beginning to end. I was present at his arrest.
You're the top, one of the top prosecutors, right? You
well,
and Kunkel?
Well, there were three of us.
Who
there
was that?
There were three of us. Bill Kunkel was the chief prosecutor of the case. And there were three of us.
Who's the third?
Terry Sullivan.
Ah, that's who Mr. Ross, another lawyer I talked to today, said, mention Terry Sullivan, if you would.
Yeah, Terry Sullivan was our third partner. And actually, there was a fourth assistant involved, a guy named Jim Varga, who we had, he had only been a lawyer a short time, but he was an expert in research, so we brought him in to do our research for us. But yeah, I was present at the at his arrest, and I was present at his execution. And I was present at pretty much everything in between.
You were present at his arrest?
I was present, yeah, the next morning. I was called at home, and I was asked to go to the police station.
Des Plaines?
Yeah, Des Plaines PD, when he was in custody, huh?
Interesting, interesting. Is this the most famous case?
I would say by far as press is concerned, sure.
What other cases have you tried? I know you're working on the E2 nightclub, and for people who aren't aware, that's the, what would you call that, a stampede or a...
Well, yeah, it was nothing less than that. It was a panic that took place, and 21 people were killed.
And so you're working on that one?
I am.
Okay. Helen Moran, or Moron as I call her.
Helen Morrison.
Morrison, that's
yeah.
it. Okay, I got
right.
her last name wrong. Her book talks about Gacy. What does she say about Gacy?
Well, I think that she says that he was compelled to do what he did. She testified at the trial that he was propelled by an irresistible impulse. She testified that that he would have done what he did even if there was a uniformed armed police officer present every time he did it. So, I mean, that was her opinion. She was a defense psychiatrist.
Have you seen her book? What do you think about her theories on serial killers?
Actually, I haven't seen her book, but, you know, she's in possession of John Gacy's brain.
Right.
My understanding is that after the execution, the family turned the brain over to her. They literally let her... She is a medical doctor, so she did take the brain, and she intends to study it, so she says. And that's a first, as far as I know.
She's touring the country with it now and selling a book with it. So that's
the
really
nice thing about our country is anybody can write a book about anything.
Yeah. What is the best Gacy book that you've seen? Have you seen anything that's been hit the mark?
I've never seen a good one.
Never?
No. I don't know. It depends on what you call a good Gacy book. I mean,
something that's factual, not opinionated.
There are facts in all of the books. There are facts in Killer Clown. There are facts in Buried Dreams. There are facts in a lot of them. But frankly, I don't really think I've seen one that really captures the essence of the magnitude of the trial or its effect on the victims or just how bad an actor John Gacy was.
Did you ever see the book that I published with Gacy, A Question of Doubt?
I believe that was a book of the letters that were written to him.
No.
Oh.
It was his side of the story.
Oh, you know, I never did see that book. I heard about it, but I never did see that book.
Okay. Well, it was a nice book. It's garbage. Horrible. But Gacy had spoke to me once on the phone, and he brought up a thing that I wanted. He said he was too fat to get through the crawl space hole.
Mm-hmm.
And did he say that in court ever?
He never did say that, no.
Is that true?
Well, you know...
And what about the accomplices that Time Life named off?
Yeah, his weight was something that we did take into consideration. The trap door leading down into the crawl space was ample. I mean, you and I could fit down there at the same time if we wanted to, and neither one of us is real slim.
So I'm bigger than Gacy or smaller? I'm smaller.
I'd say you're smaller, yeah.
I couldn't fit into his arrest jacket.
No, he was a pretty big guy.
But I couldn't fit into the jacket he was arrested in. It kills me.
Yeah, he wasn't real tall, but he was pretty strong.
You know, that was one of the most depressing days of my life, not fitting into that jacket.
Yeah. Well, the crawl space itself only had a clearance of about 28 inches from the dirt to the bottom of the floor joists. So there was some question as to whether or not he could move around down there. And we determined fairly easily that he could move around down there. He also did have these two employees that worked for him that testified at the trial, Michael Rossi and Donald Cram. I think it was Donald Cram. Donald Cram.
Right, and those are the two that the Time Life ties in to be semi-accomplices.
Yeah, that's a very popular thing to try to tie them in. As accomplices in the case, we found no evidence to show that they were anything more than unwitting dupes. Gacy essentially employed each of them to do odd construction jobs for him, and one of the jobs that he did was to to dig trenches in that crawl space, which he told them were for sewer tiles to correct a high water problem that he had down there. Those are the trenches that he eventually buried bodies in. They literally helped him build, dig the trenches. But I don't think, and we don't think that they knew what they were doing at the time that they did it.
So you did you hear about all these theories where he was partners with a gentleman who ran at Indiana State University, or Larry Eiler? They were like a tag team on some of this stuff. And I had also heard one of the victims, or someone who got away, said he was raped from both ends at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that are out floating on, like he had some sort of a snuff ring going on with a professor from Indiana State University, Larry Eiler, and him.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever heard stuff like that?
Yes, I've heard it, and it was checked out at the time these things came up, and we never found any evidence to tie them in. Of course, you know, when somebody like Larry Eiler, who was a serial killer who operated both in Indiana and Illinois.
Did you try him?
No, I did not. It had nothing to do with the trial of him. But when that kind of stuff comes up, you always look for a possible connection. They looked at it. They didn't find anything. You know, there are more than one serial killer out there, and unfortunately, and they don't necessarily know each other at all. As far as the ring was concerned, Gacy operated, as far as we were able to ascertain, Gacy operated completely independently, and had no accomplices or was not part of any sort of ring.
Have you, now, about the appeal process, I asked that already. Can criminals like a Gacy be reformed? This is the reform system, right? The correctional facilities.
Well,
the concept of that is the reform.
Very honestly, Shane, that's the fiction on which the correctional system is based. This is not a rehabilitative system at all.
This
is a retributive system. It's a system that does nothing more than punish and remove someone from society so he or she will not harm anybody else. I think that we're all kidding ourselves when we think that there's rehabilitation that goes on in the prisons. Literally, prisoners who go to prison just come out better criminals because they hang around with criminals while they're in. Can somebody like Gacy be reformed? All of the evidence and all of the studies that have been done on serial killers seems to indicate that somebody like Gacy could not be reformed. Serial killers do not seem to be susceptible to being cured, if you will. Child molesters, there's just no evidence that they can turn it around,
right.
No matter how much help they're given or guidance that they're given. At least there's no evidence of it yet.
Even through castration or anything, they just don't fix themselves. With the reform system or the prison system as it is, it seems like a slim to none chance if you go into prison you're ever going to be anything more than a criminal.
The chances are against anybody who goes to prison and gets out that they'll be anything other than a criminal. That's what they learn when they're in prison. They learn how to be better criminals.
Is that right?
Is it right? No, it's not right. It's you would think that in 2004 we could have a better system than that, but frankly, the society seems to want to just get the prisoners off, get these defendants off the street, keep them from doing it again, at least for a period of time, and I guess not much thought goes into what happens when they get out. Frankly, there are all kinds of opportunities given to them when they get out, but it's pretty much up to them whether they want to take the opportunities. There are vocational training programs, that sort of thing.
So the same character flaws that get them into prison are probably going to keep them going back and back. They don't.
Yeah, in most cases, that's what they do.
Yeah. So you'd like to see something better, but probably isn't.
I think everybody would like to see something better. I think everybody would like to know that when somebody got out of prison, that there was a pretty good chance that they weren't going to do it again. But that just isn't the case these days.
Have you ever heard of a gentleman named Andy Kahn?
No.
He works for the Houston state's attorney.
Oh.
And he runs a victims' rights group. And he's a gentleman who's went after eBay for listing serial killer stuff. He's really he's really aggressive about that, and he wants to go to the point where he wants to make it illegal for someone like myself to sell true crime artifacts at all. And eBay's made such a strict rule that, you know, you can't sell anything that's under 100 years old if there's any victims at all. How do you feel about stuff like that? How do you feel about, well, Andy Kahn and his...
Well, I don't know. It's a free country, you know. I can see where eBay, you know, can make their own rules, but
right.
All you have to do is examine eBay and all a lot of the websites that are out there. There's a market for everything.
Well, I guess eBay's they do run their own business, but what do you feel about it being against the law for someone like me to sell a painting that I get from wherever, flea market?
I do not think that's right. As long as the defendant himself doesn't profit off of it. I mean, this is a country that's based on free enterprise, and as distasteful as that might seem to some people, it's based on free enterprise. That if we say to somebody like you can't sell a painting, what's to stop us from going to somebody else and saying, we decided you can't do this, and we decided now you can't sell that?
Yeah,
I mean, where does it stop?
Bad taste is hard to.
Yeah. I mean, Howard Stern is still on every morning, and a lot of people think he's in bad taste.
You like him, don't you?
I listen to him.
Ah, right. How do you feel about the Howard Stern stuff that's going on with the FCC, then? Have you heard about it?
I have heard about it.
How do you feel about that? I mean, that's outrageous, huh? I don't know. How do you feel?
I think any time that the government starts to impinge upon our freedoms, it's dangerous. Is it right or wrong? I don't know. It depends on the circumstance, but I think that any time that you start fooling around with our freedom to do anything, whether it's to say what's on our mind, whether it's to sell what we want to sell or buy what we want to buy or read what we want to read, you're running into problems, because our country is based upon freedom. And that's freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom of religion. All these freedoms are basic to our country. And any time you start to chip away at them, it's dangerous. It's just dangerous.
Would you feel the same way if Howard Stern had Gacy on his show?
Howard Stern could have Gacy on his show, or if he was still alive, or anybody
else. The ghost of Gacy.
I don't have any problem with that. I mean, they're in business to make money, and if they can have an interview. I mean, my goodness, look at Walter Jacobson had a 2-day interview with John Gacy. And that drew all kinds of viewers.
You know, it's funny. That's what I say when people give me grief about the paintings. I say, you know, we'd be lucky if I could make as much as the news stations or the book publishers or the tabloids that publish these stories, you know.
When you stop to think about it, the only difference about what you do and what they do is a matter of degree. They're exploiting a serial killer to make money, to get people to watch.
Yeah,
and buy the products that their sponsors advertise.
And
that's what America's all about.
And my stuff is very base, you know, stuff, sure. How do you feel about John Walsh and people like John Walsh, the victims' families who choose to go public? And I mean, they make a fortune off of foundations and stuff they set up. I mean,
right.
Polly Klass's father, for instance,
mm-hmm.
He made $25,000 a year. Now he's in the $250,000 a year bracket where he runs a foundation for his dead daughter. And I don't know about what blood money is. People say that when I sell a painting, it's blood money. Or I wonder what's the difference between me and John Walsh now, or me and Polly Klass's father.
You know, John Walsh and Polly Klass's father are they have their own motivations, their own reasons for doing what they do, and we live in a country where they can do that, and they can do it freely.
Sure, but what do you think about stuff like that? I mean, it's sort of exploitive at the same as Walter Jackson.
There's no question it is.
But John Walsh had his son was sodomized while his head was chopped off.
Right, that's right.
Go on TV? I got, you know, it's just strange. It's odd to me to watch him.
How can he base his income and his notoriety on if you will, the blood of his son?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the question.
I mean, I couldn't... I try to put myself in that shoes, and that's something I could not do.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you, though, anytime you do anything like John Walsh does, or Polly Klass, his father does, or anybody that's engaged in this sort of thing, it's controversial, and it's always going to be controversial. Howard Stern is controversial. The point is not whether something is controversial. The point is whether or not we have the freedom to say it, and that's, or do it, or sell it, or read it. Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Look at it.
I'm just wondering your personal opinion on folks that do. I mean, is there a difference between me and John Walsh? Is there a difference?
I mean, you do different things, but essentially you're trading on crime. And people have been doing that since the beginning of time.
Exactly. Where's my other one? Oh, John Walsh. Okay. What causes this kind of... What do you feel causes a serial killer? Helen Morrison, the woman that wrote that book and has testified at the Gacy trial, the trial that you oversaw and prosecuted and you put Gacy to death. How do you feel about... How does someone like Gacy get created? There's a lot of theories on how that comes about, that kind of gross perversion in a person.
I don't think anybody knows for sure, but I think that they've identified certain behaviors in... serial killers that are common among serial killers. They tend to have disturbed childhoods. John Gacy had a disturbed childhood. His father was a alcoholic who beat him and who used to essentially live in his basement with a padlock on the door and wouldn't let anybody down in the basement, which of course all the psychiatrists had great fun with at the trial.
That was your argument. Was that your argument when you went? How did you guys prosecute Gacy? I mean, what?
Well, essentially, we prosecuted him with the theory that Gacy was. That part of the problem was it was insanity defense, and we had to kind of educate the jury on what is insanity, because it's real easy to say, my goodness, who would kill 33 people and bury them under his house and be sane?
Right.
Well, the fact of the matter is that that's not the definition of sanity that the law requires. The definition of sanity at the time required that a person not be able to appreciate the criminality of what he was doing, or was compelled to do what he did because of a mental disease or defect. The fact of the matter is, Gacy knew very well what he was doing. He wasn't compelled to do what he did in that sense. It was an irresistible compulsion. He did what he did because he liked it. He enjoyed killing people, and it's just that simple. People are unwilling to realize that, unwilling to admit it in this day and age, that the serial killer, which is another commonality among serial killers, when they kill their first victim, they get a kick unlike any other kick they've gotten at anything in their life. And that's where the compulsion comes to repeat it. They just want to do it again because it feels good.
It's like jumping out of an airplane, maybe?
Jumping out of an airplane. Call it what you will, winning a jackpot in Las Vegas. Call it, you know, whatever you want. They want to do it again because it's a big thrill.
It's an addiction.
That makes John Gacy and serial killers like him what one of our psychiatrists referred to as recreational killers. They kill for the same reason that people bowl, because they enjoy it. And people, unfortunately, are not willing to accept that.
You don't
but
think
it's really not more complex than that.
Do you think cavemen went around and serial killed?
Probably.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You don't think it's a symptom of the stress and the, you know, the
society? It could be, I'm guessing.
Like
it could be. You know, as I said, there's a lot of factors. I was saying earlier that a lot of the factors have been discovered that are common among serial killers. They tend to play with fire when they're kids. They tend to hurt animals when they're kids. And that's fairly common among them, although it was not with Gacy. But they do tend to be abused in one way or another. They tend to be loners. They go through life with this feeling of isolation until such time as they kill somebody, which oftentimes the first time is not really intended. They don't really set out to do it. John Gacy didn't really set out to kill his first victim. What you just said, though,
have you ever heard of Frank Zappa?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Brothers of Invention, yeah.
And the PMRC's hearings?
The what?
The PMRC hearings when they wanted to start stickering label records and stuff.
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, Tipper Gore, she wanted to start putting adult labels on
stickers. Oh, yes.
And Frank Zappa went and testified.
Okay,
and
I'm familiar with that movement. Yeah.
And one of the things he said in there, and it strikes a chord when you're saying what you're saying, is he said, they said almost the same thing you're saying.
about Gacy. They said the same thing about people who listen to music. And he said, well, if everyone that were like that, were, you know, we'd have millions of kids dead on the street because they all listen to Judas Priest. I mean, he just said it's a crazy person who'll kill themselves over Judas Priest or the color of tie that you're wearing.
Well, that
doesn't matter.
That's, of course, the fallacy with the insanity defense, in that if you say that John Gacy or a serial killer did what he did because he had a deprived childhood and was beaten by his alcoholic father and was disturbed and didn't do well in school and on and on and on, there are hundreds and thousands of people out there that went through those same things that don't turn into killers.
Right. So how's Gacy, how's that the reason that Gacy's a killer?
Well, I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that there are commonalities among them, but why a person ends up becoming a serial killer, I don't think anybody really understands completely yet.
Let me turn this tape over real quick.
Basically, the inmate will be strapped to a gurney outside of a cell at approximately 12:01 of the date of the execution. Once that is accomplished, a IV will be hooked up to the inmate. A saline solution will begin to go into his arm or wherever it's hooked to, and the inmate will then be transferred, pushed on into the execution chamber. Once in the execution chamber, the saline solution will be turned off, and he'll be hooked up to the lethal drugs. He'll then give the warden his last words. The warden will signal to the executioners to proceed with the execution. The executioners, there are two, so that they won't know who precisely it is who pushes the button, but they will depress a button on the modular execution machine. The machine chooses one side or the other, and the first drug is sodium pentothal. That would should put them to sleep. The second is pancuronium bromide, which will stop his breathing, and the third is potassium chloride, and that will stop his heart. The warden will then signal for the blinds to be drawn. After that, the inmate will be declared dead, and then the witnesses will be allowed to leave. The six official witnesses will go to an area where they will sign the official document.
As you know, he had initially requested fried chicken, French fries, and cola, along with strawberries for dessert. When he found out that the Department of Corrections had told the media about his final meal, he was furious, and he instead changed it, ordering rock lobster and raw iguana. The Department of Corrections is sticking with that original request.
Hello? Wow, it is so loud here. Okay, Mr. Egan, the prosecutor of the Gacy case. We were just talking about, I was a little distracted watching the tape. What was it that Mr. Kunkel said at the end of his closing arguments? You had given me this real great line last time I spoke with you, and I can't really remember, but it was like his closing line or his...
Well, he had a lot of closing
about
lines.
About the death penalty.
But he essentially, the argument, the position that we took with the jury was, if you're not going to impose the death penalty in the case of John Gacy, then what are we doing with the death penalty? I mean, he killed 33 people.
Don't you think that line would work, don't you think, for Gacy's lawyer saying, if Gacy's not insane, who is?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the points that they made in their final argument, Sam Amaranti, the defense attorney, held up a copy of Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde. And he analogized it to Jekyll and Hyde. Here was a guy who had one side that ran a construction business and worked every day in society, and the other side went out prowling at night killing people. And there was that similarity. And it's a very attractive argument, but still doesn't make him legally insane. And that's the whole fallacy.
What are the weirdest Gacy rumors you've heard from prison? Like I heard when I was working with Gacy, and working on that book, I worked with an editor of Playboy, actually, in Gacy's book. We heard that he was paying a prison guard for blowjobs.
I never heard that.
We heard that he was paying prison guards to leave him alone with visitors so he could masturbate in front of them and try to molest them. And that was in someone's book, as a matter of fact, an excerpt from a book called The Last Victim, where the kid said the guards left him alone and Gacy, you know, yanked it out and said, I can get you like the rest of them or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't heard those rumors, but I will tell you that if I found out they were true, it would not surprise me. One thing that John Gacy was, to the exclusion of everything else, was a manipulator and a guy who tried to manipulate any situation to fit what he wanted to do. Our main psychiatrist, Dr. Kavanaugh from Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital, was on his first interview, John Gacy laid down the ground rules and said, here's the way I will talk to you. I want this and I want that, and I want you know, only be here a certain amount of time, and so on and so forth. He had this tendency to control everything he did, to the exclusion of anyone else's feelings. If he wanted something, he went and got it. He was a master manipulator. So if you told me that he was paying off prison guards and doing things with those who, around him, in order to get what he wanted, that wouldn't surprise me a bit.
It might not also surprise you after you see those nice spec videos that came out, huh?
Yeah, those give you a pretty good idea what can happen in prison, I guess.
You know, I've got this great questionnaire from Gacy. You ever see this?
No, I never did.
It's the famous Gacy questionnaire. That's what he'd send out to everyone that wrote him. And that's the one he answered. You want to answer any of those questions? What are your favorite books?
My, oh my. I'm just looking at this for the first time.
Yeah,
it does not surprise me one bit.
Robert Egan, the gentleman who killed John Wayne Gacy. It's a funny way of putting it, but he helped put him in the...
Boy, there's a very telling answer. He's asked, what are your artistic interests? And he answers, to please myself first and hope that expression is enjoyable to others. But to please myself first, that's what his personality was all about.
You've never seen that,
thoughts,
huh?
Thoughts on sex. His first word is liberal. Whatever the will of consenting adult people who are in control of their own well-being and lives. Liberal is the first word he uses to answer that question. He asked, the first thing he asked Robert Peace before he started the process of killing him was, are you liberal about sex? And several other of his living victims said he used that word. Are you liberal about sex? And he would use that as his entree to find out if they were interested in gay sex with him.
Well, that's interesting that's evidence, and he also writes that into his bio or his bio review. That's interesting.
Part of his personality.
Wow, giving you little tips, huh?
Sure.
So you like that questionnaire, huh? Amy, did you have any questions? Do you want to? No. I know you do. You have to come over here, Mister. I'll come.
Okay.
I have a couple questions. No? Amy has no questions. I don't believe that for a second. I don't think she wants to talk in a microphone in the middle of Millennium Park, though. Mr. Egan, I got to ask you. You ever feel like killing anyone?
No, good Lord, no. Thank you. Thank God.
Not even if they cut you off in traffic?
No. No, unfortunately. Maybe it's my profession or something. Not to say I don't get angry at people, but I've never gone that far, thank God.
You think that's part of your profession. You know, the funny thing is, when I'm looking into this, getting ready to talk to you, I keep thinking back on the part of natural-born killers, where the cop gets so engrossed in this stuff that he goes out and he gets a hooker or something and he chokes her to death. And I talked to a couple of police officers and stuff, and they say that seems to be a common... side effect of police work or crime fighting is you know, there's a line that you can cross, you know, you start doing drugs maybe or do stuff like that. So when you say that, it's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Shane, I think it works both ways. When you're with some of the worst people in society, as I have been over the last 30 years, when you are dealing with them at their worst, when you're dealing with crime victims at their worst, tends, in my case, to give me an appreciation for the good things in life, to appreciation for my family and the fact that I don't have to live like some of the people that I have to deal with, so that I don't have the mental torment that goes on in their minds. And sure, do police officers sometimes quote go over to the other side, close quotes? Yeah, they do, but I think that's unfair to all the great majority, the 99.9% of police officers out there, and prosecutors, who do a good job every day and go home to their families and live a good life
and feel good about what you do.
I do feel good about what I do. We have an expression, we had an expression at the state's attorney's office that there's nothing like hearing the cell door slam. And what that means is that it gives you a great feeling of satisfaction to know that you've somehow put right something that might have been done. Done wrong. And somehow you've righted a wrong, and you've taken the person who committed the wrong, and you've taken them away from society for a while at least. It's a huge amount of satisfaction.
My goodness, I went to jail once for 3 weeks, and that jail cell door closing made me vomit for every day for those 3 weeks. Made me sick to my stomach. I was terrorized.
I can imagine.
Well, that set me straight. I was a young man, and my goodness, that's the worst kind of thing ever. Anything, you know, you also said something about if criminals ever get smart, you're out of a job, but they never will. Any other good, you got these great one-liners, and Kunkel had these great one-liners in court. Can you name off, I mean, give me some of these great...
Well, oftentimes we do have to laugh at some of the things that we run into. You know, the burglar who drops his wallet in the house that he burglarizes, or another case I handled where a smash-and-grab burglar knocked over a mom-and-pop grocery store in a neighborhood in the middle of the night, smashed the front window and took what he could out of the front window. When the police arrived, they were looking at the scene and they saw literally a trail of Kraft caramels that went down the sidewalk, across the street, and into an abandoned building. And they literally followed the trail of caramels, and they found the guy with all the stuff that he had stolen, including the almost empty bag of caramels. They thank God they screw up terribly sometimes, and it works to our advantage.
What was the worst thing about the Gacy case that still sticks with you? The worst memory, the possible absolute worst thing.
It's a part that never made the papers. It's the damage that it did to the families. Nobody really writes about that. Families were broken afterwards. I saw people who just went through terrible psychological pain, counseling. To this day, they're in counseling, as far as I know. Around the time of the execution, a lot of the anger and the rage that they experienced at the time came out again. It damages the families more than anyone realizes, and that's the part that sticks in my head.
Wow, that's Amy had this had a same similar experience with the Speck killings. She mm-hmm. had a family member involved
yeah.
in that. So similar. Anything else about the Gacy case you could think of? Will you ever write a book? Will Kunkel ever write a book?
No, actually, of course I talked about it, but I know myself well enough to know that I enjoy doing what I do, practicing law. I don't think I have the discipline to sit down and write a book. Books have been written about it, and it's pretty much old news now. You know, it's after Gacy takes place, then the O.J. Simpsons and the other things happen in our society, happen and people forget about the past. So, no, I don't think I'll do anything like that.
Did you see the Gacy DVD that's out?
You know, I haven't. I mean to rent it, but I have not seen it yet. I did see the To Catch a Killer movie that starred Brian Dennehy as John Gacy, and I thought Brian Dennehy did a great job embodying what a bad guy John Gacy was.
Yeah, I thought he was good too. Now it's funny, Gacy's lawyer thought he was horrible.
Well,
whatever.
He's entitled to his opinion.
Yeah. Oh boy, the Gacy DVD. It's funny. You know who plays Gacy? Is a guy from Pee Wee Herman.
Oh really?
Yeah,
I
forget what he played. He was like a cow. But the guy who played Gacy's from Pee Wee Herman.
Sea captain.
Yeah. Sea captain. Anything else?
No, it's been great talking to you today, Shane. It's always interesting to talk about the case. I'm constantly amazed now, 24 years after the the case was tried and 10 years after he was executed, the amount of interest that people still have in the case, I know people whose kids were not born at the time of the case who asked me questions about it. Everybody seems to be interested in it. It's a fascinating case, and I'm honored professionally to have been part of it.
Because it was successful.
Especially because it was successful. As my partner said, if we win the case, they might forget who we are, but if we lose the case, they'll never forget who we are. It's good to be successful. There's no question about that.
What do you think about kids that run around with Gacy on their T-shirts and stuff?
Well, I'd say it depends on how old they are. I don't know about that. I'm in my mid-50s now, and I'm one of those old fogies that I used to complain about when I was in my 20s. I see kids going around now the way they dress and what they do. I'm not one to judge them, though. I try not to judge them, because I'm not in a position to make judgments about what they do. If somebody wants to wear a T-shirt with John Gacy on the chest, that's up to them. I know that prosecutors back in the 70s used to wear black T-shirts with electric chairs on them, so, who am I to say?
That's funny. Any questions for me, Mr. Kunkel?
Not at all. Yeah, Egan.
Mr. Egan.
Not at all. Shane, it was great talking to you today. It's nice to talk about the case. I'm happy to have been part of your interview today and part of your radio show.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Bye.
A new potential problem with the Gacy execution. A Joliet pathologist is refusing to do an autopsy on the serial killer. The Illinois Medical Society has threatened possible disciplinary action against doctors who participate in the execution. Dr. Joseph Cipolla says he does not want to come under criticism. State law requires autopsies on all inmates who die in prison. The Will County coroner says he may have trouble finding another pathologist.
And Gacy has selected food for his last meal. He'll be served fried chicken, French fries, and fresh strawberries. The last meal will be served 6 hours before his execution, which is set for next Monday night. Actually, just past midnight, which would make it 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday.
Say goodbye. It's time to fly. Say goodbye. It's time to fly.
With 33 mock body bags representing the victims, these members of the Guardian Angels vow to remain on vigil in downtown Chicago until John Wayne Gacy is executed.
John Wayne Gacy should have been gone a long time ago. I think for his attorneys to try to get him a second chance and all that, it's a lot of waste.
Security surrounding his arrival in Joliet was stringent. Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris had said there were fears of vigilante justice, that someone might attempt to assassinate the convicted killer, but the transfer went off without a hitch. Unless the courts intervene just before midnight, Gacy will be strapped to a gurney and an IV will be placed in his arm. Then Gacy will be taken to the execution chamber, will make his final statement, and then lethal drugs will be pumped into his body through the IV, drugs that will cause him to stop breathing and then stop his heart. Then the curtain will be drawn and Gacy will die outside the view of the 28 witnesses.
Wish to celebrate the fact that justice is going to be done finally at long last, as my sign says.
I'm not celebrating a killing. I'm celebrating justice in Illinois, and I hope Jim Edgar sees it the same way as I do.
I do think it's time, definitely. 14 years too late.
He would leave the house, be gone about an hour, come back like nothing ever happened, and we never discussed it. Never. I always told him he was like a Jekyll and Hyde.
She was his wife for 4 years, all the while Gacy's Mr. Hyde, the bad side, was murdering 33 people.
Sometimes I think that's the reason John married me, to be this family man and married and still can go ahead and do what he was.
Digging graves in the crawl space and then strangling and burying 26 bodies. She remembers the opening to the crawl space in the closet in the baby's room.
Wooden piece that goes over this covers it up. And this is like inside the closet. These doors close,
mm-hmm.
And then there's a wooden cover that goes over that. I really don't know what to think, but I can't imagine him doing this. I just can't. Not getting in there. Mm-mm. He's had to have help. Little things that could start him off. If I wrote something wrong in a book of his checkbook, or if I had something sitting in the wrong place, to him that was, he would go into a tantrum that it was, I can't even explain it. Well, he's sitting behind bars and making a big deal about this whole thing and talking like he has nothing to worry about. He has no fears. Let's start getting serious about what's going to happen to him now. And I think he should get the chair.
I'm just as lovable and jokeable as I was back then. You know, I don't sit around worrying about the death penalty or things like that, no. People don't want to know the truth and the honesty of it. If they want to be convinced or brainwashed into what they believe, then fine, then go ahead and kill me. But vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, because you will have executed somebody that didn't commit the crime. When they paint the image that I was this monster who picked up like these altar boys along the street and swatted them like flies, I said, this is ludicrous. I've taken three and a half hours of truth serum. And under sodium amethyst, the maximum amount that I could have, it shows that I have no knowledge of the crime whatsoever. Never have had. Loving and caring. I've always looked after my children, even now. A lot of things that my dad did, I refuse to do. Because I don't believe in hitting children. I don't believe in spoiling a child either. And nowadays, do you realize by 1993 that 50% of the American families will be single-parented? And that shows a breakdown in the church and not being able to hold families together. And for this reason, children run away from home and seek love in other places. What do I think of Jeffrey Dahmer? I don't know the man personally, but I'll tell you this. That's a good example as to why insanity doesn't belong in the courtroom. Because if Jeffrey Dahmer doesn't meet the requirements for insanity, then I'd hate like hell to run into the guy that does.
Do you feel
beyond
so?
That, I have no comment on Jeffrey Dahmer because I'm not Jeffrey Dahmer. And I would not... whether it's Berkowitz, whether it's Bundy, whether it's Williams, Wayne Williams down in Atlanta, or any of the others, or Charlie Manson. See, I don't comment about other cases for the simple fact is that I wasn't there. I'm not only the victim here. I may be the 34th victim, but there are other victims to this crime, and that is the family. Because if I know that I didn't commit the crime, then I have been given the injustice. And so is the families. And nobody gives a damn about the families. Charge me with complicity in two of the murders. That's all I know about. Robert Peace was killed by another individual in my home. He was transported to the house by another. I believe he was strangled. Not during the crime, but I was there afterwards and I watched the removal of the body. I've always contended. Don't look at me as an innocent babe of the woods. In regards to going out into the garage, yes, I know I went to the house, and yes, I know I walked in the garage, and they asked me where the last section of concrete was poured. Okay. I said, there's the last section where the last section of concrete was poured. Okay. They are the ones that took the orange can of paint and said, here, put a mark there. So I put an X. Shoelaces, huh? You're in trouble now.
Yeah, right.
Are you afraid sitting that close to me? What the hell? Oh, this is too long. You don't need it this long. Okay, I had a rosary, which I carried in my pocket. I've always carried a rosary. It was my communion rosary. They said, well, what kind of a knot do you use? I said, what do you mean knot? When I tie things up? I says, depending on what I'm using it for, I said, the only thing I ever learned from Boy Scouts is a tourniquet knot. He said, well, show us what that is. So I took, at that time, and again, it's together, but in order to demonstrate it here, I took the rosary and I said, well, here, you put it around. This is hard trying to do this. Why don't you put your hand out? Okay, here. What I told him, I said, here, all you do is you wrap it around, you put one knot in it. And I said, then you put a second knot in it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I said, then you take a stick and stick it in here and you just turn this. And I said, it causes a tourniquet. I said, that's the only knot I ever learned. To me, clowning it was a way of relaxation for me. You regressed into childhood, you were able to relax, and you could be goofy if you wanted to, and still you had the facade of your face being covered. I used to do clowning, and I don't know if you want to mention the name, for an ice cream company in Chicago, who had 33 flavors. I'm serious, Bresser Ice Cream Company. I was their contractor, and I was also their clown. And Pogo the Clown was the clowning that I did for charity hospital work for the Democratic Party, and Pogo the Clown is originally. Pogo comes from being Polish and on the go all the time, so it's Pogo. I always felt that service community and community service to others, you know, in my religious background, I felt if you serve other people, it'll come back to serve you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always believed that way with generosity. Day to day, I live it day to day.
What do you mean?
If you want to know what my life is like, I log it every day. For the last 12 years, all you got to do is ask. I can tell you everything. I can tell you it's the first meal they serve me here because I do it daily. You know, when I tell you I've got background information on it, we took each one of them by, we took each one of the victims, and this is by their names or by their indictment numbers. And what we did with each one of them, we did profile sheets on them. We wanted to know what this kid was into, what his background was. My dad was domineering in the fact. He had a different set of values, but also very stern individual. My dad drank a lot. When he drank a lot, yeah, he was abusive to my mother and to me. But I never swung at my dad because I loved him for what he stood for. This was done by request. Somebody requested a skull clown, and mostly the punk rockers and the undergrounders like that stuff there. This is Christ as I see him in myself. And it's monolithic because Christ, to me, is monolithic. He's all things to all people. This here is the High Ho series, mm-hmm. and that is self-explanatory. It's the Seven Dwarfs, and they've always stuck to me as a great child painting. And so I've done a series of High Ho series paintings, and this is the 1990 one. This is called High Ho Around the Campfire. It's an original work. Walt Disney is a mentor for me because I've always enjoyed his creativity. And the Seven Dwarfs, if you actually look at all the faces, they represent the seven different moods that most people can get into. That one mother that gets on television all the time who thinks I should be given 33 injections, I think she ought to take 33 Valiums and go lay down. She goes on Geraldo's show and all these other shows talking about, I think it's Maori, I think is the name, her marine son. Her marine son, if her marine son was so great, what the hell did he run away from home 12 times?
Not enough for him to be murdered.
I know that. There's a misconception of what the house on Summerdale is. It's not a house where you work 9 to 5 and come home and it's like a house where you live in. The living room was the private office section. One of the bedrooms was a terrarium. The kitchen was more like a fast food kitchen. We have always contended there's others involved. At the time of my arrest, there was four other suspects. Three of the suspects that we knew that they knew then was Michael Rossi, David Cram, and Philip Paskey, all employees of PDM Contractors, all with keys to the house on Summerdale. I met him the night he was killed because I met him with Michael Rossi. I had a drink with the two of them, and then I left. And when I next seen the individual, he was dead. No, I started back in 1984. I started taking 10 milligram of Valium, and by the time 1978 came around, I was doing 130 milligram of Valium. But then I was moving 80 jobs a year, and I was working 16, 18 hour days, and I just had to have something to take the pressure off. When I was arrested, they claimed, well, there was a putrefied odor in the house. And I contend that was a lot of hogwash, too, because one officer, Schultz, claims on the 18th or on the 19th that as he came into the house, we had come into the house, and my little Lhasa Apso was in the house. And, of course, he had been locked in the kitchen, you know, all day. Well, a little puppy, he piddles, see, and while he's piddling and while he is doing his business on the paper and that, you can imagine what it smells like if you go into a closed room. And when the heat came on, as soon as the heat came on, it'd give you, you know, that strong feces odor. You know, I found it as odd when we bought the house that a house with a crawl space would need a sump pump. But then I learned the first time it rained that this ground gets wet under there and the crawl space actually floods up to a foot deep in water. And then as it recedes, it puts out a musty odor. There was always a musty odor in that house. If you believe you've lived your life the right way, then you do not have nothing to fear, in my case.
You're not worried about facing God?
No. I'm fairly comfortable with him. I've been at the Catholic services. I'm the server for the priest for the last 10 years. I have no qualms about doing that. I've had confession, I have communion, and I am at peace with myself.